Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Shlom. In 1957, the Soviet Union launched Sputnik, the first satellite to orbit the Earth. It set in motion a Cold War contest between the United States and Russia that saw early triumphs for the Soviets with the first man in space, Yuri Gagarin, the first woman in space, Valentina Tereshkova, and the first spacewalk by Alexei Leonov. The presidential election of 1960 was won by John F. Kennedy in a very narrow margin over Richard Nixon. Kennedy used the newly minted space agency, NASA, and the first seven Mercury astronauts as part of his administration's effort to counter the Soviets in what the author Tom Wolfe called the last single combat warriors, battling the Russians for the hearts and minds of countries around the world. Kennedy's gamble to beat the Soviets in a race to the moon, set in motion in May of 1961, would culminate with the successful mission of Apollo 11, when Neil Armstrong, Buzz Aldrin, and Mike Collins became the first crew to achieve a successful moon landing mission 50 years ago in July of 1969. But when Kennedy set that goal in 1961, NASA lacked the rockets, infrastructure, and personnel, from astronauts to engineers, to pull off a successful moon landing. The 1960s saw the buildup of a colossus of technology, from the launch and vehicle assembly facilities at Cape Canaveral in Florida to the many sites around the country dedicated to building, testing, and training the equipment and people, 400,000 of them at the height of the program, that would make the United States, at that time, the preeminent spacefaring nation in the world. Now that 50 years have passed since the establishment of Tranquility Base on the Moon, historians and anthropologists specializing in the space race are working to preserve and protect, to the extent that that's possible, the historical sites on Earth and in space related to our first tentative steps toward becoming a truly space-faring civilization. Our guest is one of the foremost experts in that effort, Lisa Westwood. Dr. Westwood is a registered professional archaeologist and a professor in the Department of Anthropology at California State University, Chico. She specializes in historical archaeology, including Cold War era aerospace installations and the legal issues involved in historic preservation law. She's also very well published in the field of space heritage and archaeology and is the senior author of The Final Mission, Preserving NASA's Apollo Sites, which was published by University of Florida Press in 2017. Lisa Westwood, welcome to Blue Dot.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
I'd like you to first tell us about the genesis for this project. You know, what got this started for you to write this book, and how long have you been interested in the idea of the anthropology of the space program?
That's a wonderful question. It actually goes back a long time. Even back when I was an undergraduate student at the University of Iowa, back at the place where James Van Allen was located, yes. I was very interested in physics and astronomy. And I actually tinkered with the idea of being a major in physics and astronomy. And through a series of events that were outside my control, the door to archaeology opened and I walked through it. And I became a professional archaeologist after going to graduate school. And fast forward to about the mid-2000s, I found myself back in a classroom, this time at Chico State, teaching a class in archaeology. And one of the topics that I addressed with my students is the concept of what is archaeology and how do we measure significance? What is important? And the discussion kind of evolved into, you know, the question of, does it have to be old in order to be significant? And of course, under federal law, no, it does not have to be old. But that's kind of a new concept for a lot of people. And then, of course, the space program has a lot of resources that are significant that are not very old. And so we talked about Tranquility Base and how that is one of the most important technological achievements of humanity, let alone, you know, the United States, and how important it is, but it's not very old. And even as we sit here today, we're coming up on its 50th birthday. So it's not really old when you look at archaeological sites all over the world. And so we talked about that, and I left the classroom that day thinking to myself, wow, you know, honestly, I can't believe why no one has tried to preserve or protect something that was so important to humanity. And from that day, I made it my mission to try to do everything that I could using the powers that I have as an archaeologist and a historic preservation professional and my understanding of the laws to try to bring some recognition to Tranquility Base on the moon.
What was it that, how did it come about that Tranquility Base, you know, popped up? Was that something that your students were interested in or you personally? Why was it Tranquility Base that triggered this?
Because it was the first time that humans stepped foot on another celestial body. Apollo 11 was tremendously significant. And so it is really a good example of how the first of anything is so important in human history. The first footprints of humans on Earth have been identified in Eastern Africa going back millions of years. That's an incredibly important achievement in human evolution. And the very first footprints on the moon or another celestial body represents an incredible technological achievement. And since then, we have seen the space program and technology for human space exploration just explode. And it is amazing that the amount of scientific prowess that's needed to be able to take a human who is not capable of living in the vacuum of space and adapting the technology to allow a human to survive in that atmosphere.
It is pretty amazing. You just made me think of something. When we began the space program as a result of Sputnik in 1957 mm-hmm. and competing with the Russians, doctors weren't even certain that human beings could survive in space in weightlessness, that strange things would happen to your eyes, and could people even survive? And so those first space flights, with the Mercury astronauts, were just really to see, like, can they live through this experience? And it's amazing to me to think you go from that to walking on the moon in less than a decade. It's almost hard to believe.
And not only that, but it was so risky what they were doing. In fact, Bill Fleming was a NASA staffer back in the day in the 1960s. And at the beginning of the 60s, he said, very little study has gone into exactly what's going to happen once humans step foot on the moon. We didn't know if humans were to get there and you were try to land on the surface, would you sink in? Is it rocky? All of the information that we had at the time about the composition of the moon was based on telescopes and some satellites from really far away and very grainy imagery. And so there was a lot of guesswork involved. And for that reason, I think it's really amazing how NASA then took that limited information and tried to find suitable locations on Earth that mimicked those locations to the greatest extent that we could predict them. And they took astronauts all over the world on training missions to Iceland, to Hawaii, to Sierra Blanca, Texas, of all places, just to be able to experience geology and different landforms and practice how to pick up things in spacesuits, all based on a guess. It was very risky.
Yeah. Before we go any farther, I do want to ask you about, because you wrote this book, The Final Mission, with a team. You're not the sole author. Can you tell us a bit about your other co-authors?
Absolutely. My two other co-authors are amazing. Beth O'Leary is an emeritus professor from New Mexico State University, and I met her along my path to try to seek preservation of Apollo 11, and in fact found that she was doing the same exact thing. She had received a grant from NASA and the Space Grant Consortium to actually inventory all of the artifacts that are up on Tranquility Base. And she's been, we joined forces and we haven't stopped since. My other co-author is Milford Wayne Donaldson, and he is the former State Historic Preservation Officer for California. He is also currently the chairman of the Advisory Council on Historic Preservation in Washington, D.C. Wayne is amazing. He is such a space nerd, and I say that with all the love in the world. He owns a Futuro, which is that spaceship, formed house. It's really amazing type of architecture. He is a historic architect, and he has had an interest in space history and the space program for a very long time, and he was instrumental in helping us get Tranquility Base listed on the California Register of Historical Resources.
So tell us a bit about it, because there's not just California, there's some, I think, is it New Mexico?
Yes.
Tell us about the legal issues that go on. Why would the state of California want to do that?
That's a great question. And we tackled this back in 2009 when we first proposed this. Let me preface this by saying that getting the Tranquility Base listed on a state register is a step in the process to eventually get to what we hope is an inscription on the World Heritage List. There's a long path to get to that point, and it's convoluted and it's interwoven with international treaties, and it's very complicated.
So those are places like Machu Picchu and
exactly.
those UNESCO World Heritage sites,
correct.
Right?
The Pyramids at Giza,
okay.
The Great Wall of China, things that are important to all of humanity, not just to one particular mm-hmm. country. So the process of getting to the World Heritage List started out way back here in California. What we did was we looked at the laws in California and whether or not a cultural resource has to be physically located within the political boundaries of California. State law in California does not require that. It only needs to be associated with California. And there is so much association between Tranquility Base and California.
Yes, because, you know, I can recall as a child growing up in Southern California, we had friends who worked for North American Rockwell, and they would bring me home, you know, I'm sure they were outdated at the time. There were old manuals for the command module and the service module that they were building, and they would give them to me, you know, and say,
I hope you saved them.
No, I didn't.
Oh, no.
No. So thanks for reminding me of that, Lisa. That's
now
so,
you know
better. So nice. You took a fond memory and turned it into just a terrible regret. And Rocketdyne was the place in the Santa Susana Pass,
yes.
And we can talk about that in a moment, where they were testing the engines.
Yes.
And, you know, that was something that was just a part of daily life in Southern California. At night, you know, you could see the lights in the sky over to the west of us just a few miles away. And, you know, if you asked, people would say, oh, they're testing the rockets up at Rocketdyne again, getting ready to go to the moon. So, yeah, a lot of this stuff, you know, as a kid, I always thought of, you know, Project Apollo, Houston, Kennedy Space Center, it's all happening there. But, you know, what I didn't really, you know, dawn on my little 8-year-old brain was like, no, it's all happening here too.
It is, and it's happening at places all over the country. And that's really the focus of our book, was to highlight some of these lesser known sites. I mean, everybody knows about Cape Canaveral and everybody knows about Mission Control. And I certainly don't mean to minimize their importance in the space exploration, but you know, there's some really amazing places.
Tell us about some of the ones that, you know, you found most amazing that maybe you discovered that you didn't know about before.
I didn't know that Michigan had a role in space exploration. Kenai Rocket Range. Who would have thought? Some of the early test rockets went off, and that's actually Michigan's only tie to the space race that I'm aware of.
I think Jim McDivitt went to the University of Michigan.
That might explain why.
there you go.
Exactly. Yeah, you know, places like that. Santa Susana, as you mentioned, is a really fascinating place for me. It really exemplifies one of the things, the characteristics of these rocket test facilities that we see across the country. And that is, it's that yes, they have amazing rocket test stands, and they were important for R&D for developing the Saturn V rockets that took Apollo to the moon. But they also were selected, their locations were selected for a specific reason. Notice that at Santa Susana, it's in a very remote area. And there's a lot of topography that's blocking the view in a lot of cases. Same thing in Sacramento. And you have Aerojet Rocketdyne picking these locations in the middle of these mine tailings in these very remote areas. Edwards Air Force Base, a lot of research went on there and a lot of astronaut training went on there. These are remote locations that were selected for a reason, and that was to keep these, you know, the eyes of people that we don't want looking at what we're doing away. In other words, we have to remember the context of all of this was in the Cold War space race. Mm-hmm. There was a lot of paranoia and concern about spies. And so NASA was very deliberate in selecting locations that were naturally shielded from other people. Now, there's only so much you can shield from the community when you're, you know, when you're blowing up rockets.
Yeah.
can see
well,
that.
Well, it was, you know, literally just mm-hmm. a few miles away from our home in the San Fernando Valley. But, you know, back then, those hills were pretty primitive.
They were.
And, you know, there's an interesting, you know, postscript to that is the environmental cleanup
yes.
involved, because now it's a site that's, you know, very, they're having all kinds of issues with, you know, all the chemical and
right.
contaminants that are there that are, you know, damaging the groundwater and that kind of thing. So there's that aspect of it too.
And that's something that we see that's pretty common. In fact, one of the unfortunate things about Rakatestans is that environmental cleanup or remediation and historic preservation sometimes are mutually exclusive. And what I mean by that is that sometimes in order to clean up the hazardous waste, you have to remove some of the facilities that are themselves historic. So in the case of Santa Susana, NASA actually embarked on a very thorough documentation program as mitigation for the remediation. And they actually commissioned 3D laser scanning of all of these rocket test stands and actually created a virtual tour of Santa Susana that you can access online.
Wow.
It's amazing. And basically what it is it follows and actually is above and beyond what is required by a program called the Historic American Engineering Record. Documentation and HARE, as it said, is administered through the National Park Service, and it is a series of documentation specifically to recover and document these facilities in all of their detail. This type of documentation was done a number of years ago, fortunately, for Notre Dame. And after the fire just recently, fortunately, those 3D laser scans are now helping people reconstruct, or will help people reconstruct the parts that were lost in the fire.
If you're just joining us, our guest is archaeologist Lisa Westwood, and we're talking about the preservation of historical sites on Earth and on the Moon related to the Apollo-era space race. I'm Dave Shlom, and you are listening to Blue Dot. And we're back, and thanks for listening. Let's return now to our interview with Lisa Westwood. The archaeologist is the senior author of The Final Mission, Preserving NASA's Apollo Sites.
Let's talk about some of the more famous places. Mm-hmm. What about, because I remember going there as a seven-year-old, the Kennedy Space Center.
It
was 1967. It was just a few months after the fire that had killed the Apollo 1 astronauts, so there was kind of that hanging over it. There was definitely... That was just emotionally hanging there during my visit. You know, you could tell there was a lot of sadness, and it was mentioned on the tour. Talk about, you know, what's left there of the Apollo era, and what have we lost?
That's a great question, and it's kind of a passion of mine is kind of trying to find these old rocket test stands. And I recently went to Kennedy Space Center, and I was able to get a tour, a behind-the-scenes history tour, that my understanding is they no longer do. We went and visited all of these rocket test pads and included the Apollo 1 site. And it was very moving to be there. You pull up to it and you get out, and it's just this concrete structure now. Everything else has been removed, and it's stamped on the side with the words abandoned in place.
Yeah.
It's a very moving place. You know, there's a lot of emotion from people, and you see them when they come and visit, and it's understandable. It was a really horrible event in our history, but it's so wonderful that the Apollo program was able to move on and honor the legacy of the Apollo 1 astronauts. So those are there. There are a lot of other test stands that are still present, but they're being slowly reclaimed by the jungle. The roads are deteriorating.
Because, you know, that Florida coast, that's not exactly conducive to,
preservation.
Preservation of metals.
So true.
So, so those, and I also saw in your book the launch umbilical towers, those giant towers that, we've lost those?
Well, in some cases, yes. Most of the rocket test stands don't have them anymore. The one that is still there, although it's not in its original form, is Launch Pad 39A. And that's the one that took Apollo 11 with Saturn V up to the moon. It was then remodeled for the space shuttle. And then even more recently, it was remodeled for SpaceX. And you can still go there, and they're still using that same launch facility. And I'm so glad that they're doing that, because if you stop using it, it's going to deteriorate just like all of the other ones that are out there that are falling apart.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah.
That's amazing. And, of course, the vehicle assembly building is still there.
It is.
And it just... The most impressive thing I think I ever saw as a child was that building. I'll never forget the tour guide, and I don't know if this is actually true or not, but he said this, and it always stuck with me to this day. He said, well, you see that building over there, and of course, you're quite far away in this bus, and you're looking at it, it just looks like a little box out there, and you realize, that's far away, that's big. And then you start to see some of the trucks and things parked around it, and then you realize those are very large trucks, and they look tiny next to this thing. He says, well, if you took the Empire State Building and you cut it in half so it wasn't quite as tall, you could fit four Empire State Buildings inside that building. And I was just, that was jaw-dropping. And that building, that was built to get us to the moon.
It was. And it's amazing. It's still there, and you can go tour it. And I know they've converted a lot of those facilities into visitor centers and things like that. You can actually walk in and see a Saturn V lying on its side. It's incredibly large. It's overwhelming. I remember when I was, it was a long time ago, back in the 1980s, and I went down to Cape Canaveral, and actually it was during the space shuttle era, and you could see these large crawlers that would carry the space shuttle, the orbiter and its tanks, all the way across, very slowly across these very, these gravel roads.
Yeah, they're crawling along at less than a mile an hour.
It was amazing. And when I was back there just recently on a tour, they showed us those driveways or pathways are still there. And they talked about how deliberately they had to select the type of material for those crawler paths so that it could withstand the weight.
Yeah, because those things were just, the rocket alone weighed six million pounds.
Exactly.
And then not to mention all the other stuff and the crawler. Those things were just, that's the thing that struck me back in 1967 is we hadn't launched an Apollo mission yet.
Yeah.
But you could just see from the infrastructure that this is a massive undertaking.
It's incredible.
Let's go back to the moon.
Yeah.
Because one of the things that I, for a long time, there was this moon hoax thing out there that I really don't care to get into. Because thank goodness that's really died down.
Yeah.
I don't notice hearing about it. I don't think people take that seriously anymore like they used to. For a while there, I'm sure there are still people out there, but they're in a very small minority, just like the flat earth type people. And I don't give them any mind. But one of the neatest things for me is the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter photographs of the landing sites.
It's incredible.
Because they show us, the Apollo 11 and all of the sites, and you can see the tracks from Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin.
You can. You can see the lander is still there. You can see the laser ranging retroreflector that is still actively measuring the distance between the moon and Earth through the Apache Summit Observatory in New Mexico. It's amazing. The level of accuracy and precision and the resolution of these images is absolutely stunning. But seriously, getting back to the moon hoax thing, I think why that has finally started to die down is there was a filmmaker who did a documentary on this very issue. It's called Moon Hoax Not. And what he concluded as a professional filmmaker himself was that in 1969, we had the technology to get to the moon, but we did not have the technology to fake it.
To fake it, yeah. It would be much harder. And then, the thing reading your book, it's... you think about all of these sites that you've talked about in your book, all over the country that were associated with the space race, in so many different states, and so many different people working, 200,000 people working on this project.
It's amazing.
You're not going to keep that a secret if it's a hoax.
Exactly.
200,000 people can't keep a secret.
Well, and then you just talk to the astronauts and
that's...
the passion that they have in their eyes for
certainly.
Being on the moon. I mean, I was floored when I had an opportunity to talk with Buzz Aldrin, just an amazing person, and the experiences that he had, that he was so willing to share, just truly amazing.
My personal favorite one of those was, and I've had a few, but was Gene Cernan, the last man to walk on the moon.
Oh.
And we played golf in a golf tournament together. I played with Jim McDivitt, the commander of Apollo 9. And who later was the head of the Apollo program.
Yeah.
But Gene was in the group in front of us, and we spent a lot of time together. And he just said to me, he said, you know, Dave, I can't tell you where I left. Every piece, every tool, my rock hammer, where I carved my daughter's initials in the lunar regolith.
Oh,
I can
amazing.
Tell you where I left all of that stuff. And just the way he said it, the passion that he said it in, it's like, yeah, I'd like to see somebody who doesn't believe he went to the moon stand here and
exactly.
face this guy face to face, because you couldn't do it, because this guy's the real deal.
Exactly.
So, yeah, it's one of the wonderful things about celebrating the 50th anniversary of the moon landing is, you know, we really do need to honor the legacy of what America did 50 years ago, because it's just amazing. And, the neat thing about your book is it's like, it's in the past, it's 50 years ago, and yet, you know, we do need to think about preserving this history.
Oh, so true. And, you know, I think that if there's one pattern that I've seen in historic preservation is that sometimes we don't realize how important it is to preserve something until after it's been damaged. Think about all of the sites and national parks out west, for example. You know, a lot of them were formed after it was realized they were being looted. Unfortunately, there was a time in American history back in the 1800s when museums on the East Coast were looking to fill their museum halls, and they sent out expeditions, and they went out and they pot hunted, which is, you know, obviously illegally or unethically digging up things and taking them back to fill their exhibits. And it caused damage. And even though their intention was to preserve those artifacts, the minute you take something out of its context, you take it out of the site, it's no longer in situ, you lose some of that information that's associated with that. And it actually diminishes the significance of those resources. And so people realized finally, oh gosh, maybe we shouldn't be just going out and just allowing people to dig things up. Let's protect these after the damage has been done. Well, we are in a position here with Tranquility Base in particular where we have the ability to do something now to protect it from damage before the damage happens. And I feel like if we as a society have the ability to preserve that for future generations, we have an obligation to do that.
And, you know, I'd like to imagine ourselves, say, 1,000 years in the future, because, you know, you as an archaeologist and a professor of anthropology, you know, you teach your students about, you know, exploring the past. And a lot of times it is, you know, millennia ago. So imagine, you know, an archaeologist maybe from another civilization, not ours. What would they deduce if they came to a place like Tranquility Base and just, you know, say the Earth is uninhabited for whatever reason anymore? We've destroyed ourselves, which is possible.
Yeah.
What would they deduce looking at that? What, you know, put yourself in archaeologist of the future coming to that place.
Yeah, it's an interesting philosophical question. And when I look at Tranquility Base as an archaeologist now, I see a lot of information about humanity and about human technological advancements that exists only within those artifacts and is not documented elsewhere. In fact, some of the tools that are up there at Tranquility Base are there as one-of-a-kind tools. They exist only in prototype form on Earth. Some NASA staffers that I have encountered over the years have told me stories about how there was a lot of research and development into these scoops and tongs and scales and things like that that were used to collect scientific samples while they were up there. But when they figured out through the testing that it didn't really work, they made a modification, but they didn't necessarily document why they had to do that. There are researchers at the Smithsonian who are trying to back into the technology and study things like heat shields. Why did we end up with these heat shields the way that we did? Because nobody documented it back then, because they weren't thinking about that. And I wouldn't expect them to at the time.
No, they're just trying to get the job done.
They had to meet Kennedy's directive.
Mm-hmm.
And so I certainly don't blame them for that. And in fact, sometimes we don't realize that we're in the midst of a historic moment until long after it's passed. So that perspective may not have been there. But the reality is those tools up there, they represent a snapshot in time of the technological achievements of that era. And and one of the things that we look at archaeologically, be it in any type of archaeological site, Native American, European American, Chinese, we look at changes in technology through time. And it really, really is interesting to see that. Now, that's one aspect. That's the selfish archaeologist looking at it. But the other value to these artifacts that are up on the moon is looking at what the lunar environment does to materials that are made on Earth. You know, we made these materials, took them into the vacuum of space, and left them on the surface. And are these materials going to decompose slower than they would on Earth? Would the solar radiation accelerate the decomposition of the materials? There's all sorts of material science questions that can be answered. And I know that that's a goal that we share with NASA itself. As well.
Well, then on the moon, you know, there's no oxygen to oxidize those materials. There's no weather.
Mm-hmm.
The only thing that can deteriorate them, I suppose, is micrometeorites over time.
Absolutely.
Those things, that place, Tranquility Base, is going to stay in a relatively pristine condition for a very long time.
As long as nobody goes there.
Yeah. Now, so let's talk about that, because one of the things I really found interesting in your book was the Google Lunar X Prize.
Yes.
So I want you to tell us about what is that?
So the Google Lunar X Prize is a monetary prize that was established a number of years ago as an award for the first team to send a robotic probe or a robotic piece of equipment to the moon to drive a certain distance through remote control and take high-resolution photographs and send them back to Earth. The first team to do that would get, I think it was $20 million.
When was this?
This was back in the 2010-ish. The Google Lunar X Prize has more or less gone defunct. Nobody actually met it, even though they extended the deadline.
Mm-hmm.
But why it was concerning was that they had an extra bonus prize for anybody that could go to an Apollo site. And why that concerned historic preservationists like myself and my colleagues Beth and Wayne is that the moon is 250,000 miles away. Imagine driving, you know, a remote control car from that far away. You don't want to get too close, because the very act of driving up to it, creating new tracks and crushing artifacts, can be very damaging. In addition, landing a spacecraft near any of these Apollo sites can cause what's been called plume ejecta, which is basically the thrust.
The rocket exhaust is throwing lunar material up in a ballistic arc.
And
with the 1/6 gravity, it's going to go a long ways.
It is. And so my colleague Beth O'Leary was invited by NASA to help develop some guidelines for spacefaring entities a few years ago, where it basically sets some guidelines and parameters for how close you should be getting or should be staying away from the Apollo sites. They set the bar at 2 kilometers, because the idea was that if you're at least 2 kilometers away, you know, any of that exhaust is not going to damage the sites. But these are just guidelines. There's no teeth in it. There are no moon cops. It's not like going to a national park where you have a ranger in stanchions and security cameras. So the big question is, how do we encourage people who in spacefaring entities and nations, how do we encourage them to be respectful of these sites that are so important to all of humanity so that we don't damage them? And raising awareness is one of the best ways we can do that. But we're also trying to reach to that World Heritage List designation very slowly.
You're listening to Blue Dot. I'm Dave Shlom. We're going to take a short break, but when we come back, we'll continue our conversation with archaeologist and professor of anthropology at California State University at Chico, Lisa Westwood, as we talk about the issues around preserving the modern-day archaeological sites related to Project Apollo 50 years after the first moon landing. Stay with us. And we're back. Let's return now to our conversation with space history expert archaeologist Lisa Westwood. She's one of the authors, along with her colleagues Beth O'Leary and Milford Wayne Donaldson, of The Final Mission, Preserving NASA's Apollo Sites.
Okay, archaeology in general, we try to be careful about not providing direct access to archaeological sites to the public without some kind of control or education. A lot of people can do damage to archaeological sites without meaning to. Certainly it's not implied that everybody that visits a site is going to damage it, but that's one thing that we are always very careful about. But I think, though, the other thing, though, about a dome is that if you were to put it in a dome, you would lose the kind of the feeling of being in vast open space.
Yeah.
One of the things that makes Tranquility Base so amazing, in my opinion, just as an archaeologist, is that you have this in situ set of artifacts and equipment that was left in place, and the backdrop is just this vast gray, massive planet with no trees, no atmosphere. It's black. It's solitude. It's peaceful. And if you build a big dome over the top of that, I would think that would probably take away from that feeling.
The power of that experience.
The setting and that power of being there.
I'm just trying to imagine, you know, a couple hundred years from now, I can't imagine that we won't have the capability to go to the moon.
Mm-hmm.
Right now we can, but don't, because it's just not economically, it doesn't make sense. People ask me all the time, well, why don't we go back to the moon? I said, because it cost $30 billion in 1960s, okay?
Exactly.
So, and there's no compelling reason to go to the moon. But that said, I can imagine, you know, something like, I don't know, those buses from 2001, A Space Odyssey, where there's shuttle buses that fly over. I can imagine like tours.
Yeah.
Where, you know, we're not going to get too close, but you get to looking out the right hand window. That's Tranquility Base. You can see where Neil Armstrong and that the flag is no longer standing.
Right.
Most people don't realize that the flag
That's
got
right.
knocked down.
It did. Plume ejecta.
Yeah. That was one of the things they learned from, you know, Apollo 11 is put the flag farther away.
Yes, exactly right. Yeah, it's there's a lot of artifacts that got blown in kind of all of that that exhaust, but they still remain generally in the same location as they were when they left it.
Yeah, when all that flack was going on about the movie First Man mm-hmm. not showing the planting of the flag on the moon, I told people, I said, well, they were being respectful, because if they showed that, they'd need to show it getting knocked down, and nobody wants to see that. Let's talk about your students. What did they think of their professor's work on all this stuff? Because that's got to be you know, I'm going to take an archaeology class, yeah. and then all of a sudden I'm learning about the moon race.
Right? It's so different. It's not, the field of space archaeology is very narrow,
yeah.
and there's very few of us that actually.
So what do they think of that?
They all love it. I mean, it is such an interesting application of heritage space law and heritage preservation law that it's really interesting. And I think that most of my students today were not around during the Apollo era. They were born long after that. And so they don't necessarily have the personal connection, like some of the things that you were talking about earlier, but they still recognize it as being something incredibly important. And I get lots of comments and messages from my students saying how that's just amazing. They never even thought about preserving or recognizing Apollo 11 in this way. And so the support has been absolutely wonderful, all over the world, in fact. I mean, I get calls and emails from people in other countries saying, hey, I have a story. You know, I have a personal connection to Apollo and to Tranquility Base. And it's just so wonderful to hear that.
Yeah, there's so many people who worked for, you know, the contractor companies like TRW.
Exactly.
And they all have these wonderful stories to share about the part that they worked on. You know, I was reading a book today by a guy who worked on the recovery process mm-hmm. for Apollo 11. And he tells this story of 1969, you know, technology. He's got a little 12-inch color TV, and it's really small. And so they want to get it to where the couch is pulled up close because he doesn't have to work that weekend of the moon landing, but they want to watch, you know. So he and his wife is pregnant, and he moves the couch closer and gets the TV closer, and he's kind of frantically moving around, and he kicks the cord, knocks the TV over, he catches the TV, but he severs the cord. And, you know, so then it was like,
you were doomed.
Well, he's like, no, you weren't, because back then TVs were the kind of thing that you could fix yourself. So he figured out I can fix this. And he goes to Radio Shack. You know, there's an archaeology thing for you there
right.
that no longer exists.
Exactly.
He goes to Radio Shack, gets the cord, but he's in such a hurry on his way back, he winds up getting in a terrible accident. And he survives, but the story goes when he's watching the moon landing, he's still in a state of shock after all of this. But just, you know, so many stories like that by so many people. He had a vital role to play in that mission. It was a small part of just a huge machine, but he was a big part of that particular part. So, you know, there's so many of them with so many stories.
And I hope that they write those down.
Oh, yeah.
Because so many of these stories, these personal connections, are lost once people pass on.
Yeah.
And we're
seeing.
And
then it's just, you know, my grandpa worked
right.
on, I think he worked on the space program, but they don't really know.
Right. I mean, it's as simple as taking out your cell phone and recording a conversation with your grandfather.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me about your work, you know, and how you made this one particular bolt for the command module, you know, and just keeping that for
and
future generations.
And you have to think in Northern California, where the show is produced, there's got to be people who worked for Aerojet, Rocket, North American Rockwell in Southern California, retired up here.
Moffitt, you know,
yes,
it's not too far.
So many people out there with so many stories. Tell us about some of these legal issues that are involved with going about preserving sites, because that's, you know, that's the really kind of difficult part, isn't it?
It really is. And that's the challenge that we've been tackling over the past decade or so as we're doing this. Here's the issue. And I'm not an attorney, but this is what I know. The laws that govern property in space are basically similar to what is done in international waters. We're talking about international territory here, the moon. There are a couple of laws, the 1967 Outer Space Treaty and I think it's the 2002 United Nations Moon Agreement, both establish the fact that no one can own the moon. However, nations that send materials, equipment, personnel up to the moon, states as they're called, but that's the term for mm-hmm. nations in international law, states that send their property up there retain ownership of that property in perpetuity. They never relinquish that property. So the 106 objects at Tranquility Base right now themselves, those are owned by NASA. However, no one can own the lunar surface. So NASA doesn't own the the ground below these artifacts.
So the footprints?
The footprints are like a negative depression in mm-hmm. the lunar surface. So when we did the nomination for listing on the California Register of Historical Resources and the New Mexico Register of Cultural Properties, we were very deliberate in describing Tranquility Base as just a three-dimensional relationship or organization of objects that are owned by NASA. We did not include the footprints. We did not include the surface and the context around it, which is a departure from typical archaeology.
Because you would think that the footprint, especially that first boot print by Neil Armstrong.
I'm sure that's gone.
Yeah, that's gone from the plume ejecta, mm-hmm. isn't it?
Yeah.
I didn't think of that, but that's true.
You can still see the tracks going out to what's called Neil's Crater, mm-hmm. and you can see their footpaths are still there, and you can see that from the LRO. So those are still there because they were far enough away from...
Right, but the prints right around mm-hmm. the bottom, the descent stage that's still there, that's all gone.
That's all gone.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. I mean, well, I should say no one's been back since then, have they?
No.
But that's our best guess by looking at the footage.
Yeah, and just the physics of it.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
Well, that's disappointing.
I know.
But there are photographs of it.
There are photographs.
Now, and in a strange oddity of Apollo 11, and this is a bit of a tangent here, is that there are no photographs of Neil Armstrong.
Well, he was holding the camera most of the time,
wasn't he? Yeah, but Buzz had a camera too. He just, for whatever reason, I think this, chalk this up to mission planning, is, nobody told him, hey, make sure you take pictures of Neil and, Neil take pictures.
Exactly.
I don't think it occurred to him. I don't think he did it deliberately. Like, I didn't get to step on the moon first, so I'm not going to take pictures
of
Neil. I don't think he was like that. I think he was just so, okay, I'm supposed to document this and this and this. And nobody told him, take pictures of the commander.
No, and they rehearsed all of the things that they needed to do ahead of time. Mm-hmm. They had a very programmed set of tasks that they had to do. They had a mission to complete, and that was their job. They weren't there to be heroes. They weren't there to be rock stars. They were there to get a job done.
Yeah.
And they got the job done. And then they left. But what was amazing when they left, and why Tranquility Base is so fascinating as an archaeological site, is that when you think about the physics of having to depart the moon, and you go in the ascent stage to go back up to the command module.
And so basically what you're using is you've got this two-part spacecraft, the lunar module with the ascent stage with its own engine, the descent stage with its rocket engine,
which is still there,
descending, which mm-hmm. is still there. And so the descent stage essentially is a launching pad for the upper part, the ascent stage that the astronauts are in.
Correct. It broke into two pieces intentionally, and then the ascent stage went back up. Now, when they were going back up, they had to be very careful of weight balance, because if you have too heavy of sediments, or you have all these samples they were taking in, which, by the way, they didn't know how much they would weigh before they went to the moon, because this was the first time they'd been there, they were just guessing, they had to do a delicate balance to make sure that they didn't have too much weight, and then they wouldn't have enough fuel to get back up to the command module. So right at the very end, just before they took off, Neil and Buzz had to just discard a whole bunch of stuff they didn't need. Moon boots, extra scales, the cameras, these things that were done that they were used.
They'd done their job, and they really, it'd be nice to have them in a museum,
right?
But they had to just discard them.
They had to, because they had all these rock samples. And so what they did was they created, in about 90 seconds, they created an artifact toss zone. And these artifacts are still there in that little location right there off the lander. In the original place, they were just tossed.
Just a pile of stuff.
Yeah, just a pile of stuff. Stuff that again, only exists in that form, one-of-a-kind form, because we only have prototypes back here on Earth.
Yeah, wow.
So that kind of thing is what fascinates archaeologists, looking at why did these sites form the way they did? Why were they all in this location? We're fortunate that we have photographs and we have video, albeit grainy, of this activity that created the site. But when you look at archaeology overall, when we look at sites that are 10,000 years ago, we don't have the benefit of the video. We have to reconstruct the history of that site and the site formation process based on information and the artifacts and the positional relationship between them and things like that.
Here's another one for you. You made me think of this, is that when Eagle, the lunar module, when they were docked with the command module, Columbia, the astronauts and the rocks are on board, and they discard mm-hmm. Eagle, and it's crashed into the moon. So all of the lunar modules were crashed into the moon, and we don't know their exact locations, do we? No,
I think because it can be
I'm just wondering, someday in the future, you know, that might be an interesting archaeological thing, is to find those, you know, the wreckage of those lunar modules. But here's the thing. Of course, Apollo 13, the lunar module burned up, but there is one. Snoopy from Apollo 10 is out there in heliocentric orbit, orbiting the sun.
Yes.
And I just, you know, I was thinking about this because I knew I was going to talk to you today. And my mind just went to inside of Snoopy. What would it be like to be inside of Snoopy right now?
Oh, my gosh.
What would I see? What would it be like to be?
A time capsule.
Oh, my gosh. Yes. And it's just... What would you see? When just imagine knowing that it's there. It is there somewhere. It's out orbiting. I know they haven't been able to, you know, compute the orbit and actually find it, but it's out there somewhere.
And someday somebody will find it. And
can you imagine that?
Oh, you know,
that's a great science fiction story right there.
Right. I mean, you could imagine looking in through the window, if you could even see through it, and seeing a little floating pencil, you know, that was last used by General Stafford. You know, it's amazing. Yeah.
Well, I did ask him the other day. I said, well, if I were to look inside of Snoopy, what would I see? And he said, a lot of garbage. we took all the stuff out of the command module that we didn't want, and just trash and stuff we'd used, you know, and we just dumped it all in there. So he said, mostly you'd see a lot of garbage.
And that's so funny that you say that, because that's really what archaeologists study, is the stuff people leave behind. It's amazing what you can learn about society
from their
garbage. Yeah. It's one of the things, the activities that I have my college students do, is go look in the trash can of a neighbor. You know, I'm careful, just don't pick through it or anything, but just kind of glance over. What do you see in there? Can you tell if there are females or males living there? Can you tell anything about economic status? Can you tell anything about diet? Those are the same questions that we ask in archaeology. And so that's why sites like Tranquility Base, with all the stuff that they just threw down there that they considered trash, is so interesting to archaeologists.
Wow. Well, Lisa, it's been a delight to talk to you about your wonderful book, The Final Mission, Preserving NASA's Apollo Sites, and the archaeology and the future archaeology of our sites on the moon. So thanks so much for joining us on Blue Dot.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks again to our guest, Lisa Westwood. The book she co-authored with Beth O'Leary and Milford Wayne Donaldson, The Final Mission, Preserving NASA's Apollo Sites, was published in 2017 by the University of Florida Press, and it's available through most major booksellers. Lisa and I had such a great time talking about Project Apollo that we agreed to put on a panel discussion at Chico's Gateway Science Museum on July 16th to celebrate the launch date of Apollo 11 on that day 50 years ago. If you live in the area, I hope you can join us. We'll also be joined by her co-author and colleague Beth O'Leary. A link to O'Leary's NPR interview about preserving the Apollo 11 landing site can be found on our website. Blue Dot is produced in beautiful Northern California by North State Public Radio. We're distributed by the Public Radio Exchange, better known as PRX. You can check out this and past episodes at our website, mynspr.org, or better yet, subscribe to us. Our podcast is on the NPR One app, iTunes, or wherever you get your podcast groove on. Our theme music is by Matt Schultz. Blue Dot is engineered and produced by the maestro, Mr. Matt Fidler. Our assistant producer and owner of A Dog Named Rocket is Ellie Johnson. Hey, congratulations to Ellie and all of her fellow graduates in the class of 2019. For all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.